Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's tax day, and the financial meltdown has made it a little more interesting this year. More Americans are filing their own tax returns to save money. People hit hard by the economy are now getting hit on their 1040s. And then there are those Tea Party protests. Are they grassroots, or as columnist Paul Krugman calls them, astroturf, a fake tempest in a teapot? Let's start with Sandra Block. She's personal finance reporter for USA Today. Sandy, how many more taxpayers are filing their own returns?
Well, it's hard to tell at this point because we're going to get a big surge today. People who owe tend to file at the last minute. But the early signs are that it's a big jump because both H&R Block and Jackson Hewitt have reported a decline in business at their retail outlets where they have tax preparers doing people's taxes. And meanwhile, TurboTax has seen an increase in its business. And there's been a really big increase in people filing their taxes using these online tax prep programs, which tend to be less expensive. So that makes a lot of sense.
Well, you reviewed tax preparation software, TurboTax and H&R Block's software that people use to prepare their own taxes. Some of it is free online. What's your sense of it? Is it for everybody?
I think it's fine if you have a pretty straightforward tax return, and I really have a hard time imagining why you would pay someone $150 to do a 1040 EZ. If you only have a few deductions, maybe your mortgage interest and charitable contributions, you don't have self-employment income, and you just have the time, I think there's no problem with it.
Well, let's address the special considerations that people have who might not have had it in other years because they've been hit hard by the economy. You know, for instance, if people had to withdraw from pensions, they're, you know, having to deal with that now, aren't they?
Yes, this is really going to hit some folks hard because a lot of people last year, because of economic difficulties, had to take emergency withdrawals from their 401ks or their IRAs. And that money is taxable when you file your taxes. And people can be really shocked by that because it could easily eat up a third of the amount that you withdrew. And since it wasn't usually withheld, you owe it when you file your taxes.
And how about if you received unemployment benefits?
Many people don't realize that unemployment benefits are also taxable. And unless you arrange for withholding when you sign up for unemployment, and most people don't, you could end up owing money on that too.
And what about people who suddenly found themselves self-employed for the first time?
I think this is a good argument for getting help with your taxes because self-employment income is complicated. You're not having your taxes withheld as you do when you work for somebody. And you're also eligible for a lot of deductions that could reduce the amount of taxes you owe. But unless someone can sort of walk you through what's available, you might miss them.
Yeah. Well, and you've also told us, we want to touch on this, that you get a lot of reader email about these teabag protests that are taking place in several hundred cities today. What are people saying to you? What are they protesting?
Well, people, even before this latest Tea Party protest came up, people email or comment a lot on our website about their dissatisfaction with paying taxes. And it's not just that they don't like to pay taxes, but that they think the code is too complicated. They think that it's unfair that they have to pay somebody or even buy software to do their taxes. They want it to be simpler. And this is a time of year when those folks really make themselves heard.
And are they going to be part of the protest? Are you hearing that?
I think so. This has sort of stoked those folks. I mean, I think the question is, are these just the noisiest people or are there really a lot of them?
Sandra Block, personal finance reporter for USA Today. And by the way, no relation to H&R Block. Sandy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. And Rick, you know, is this a grassroots movement or not? You know, is it AstroTurf fake?
I would say it's grassroots with some fertilizer from the top. They've definitely gotten help from big organizing entities out there, Dick Armey's group, Newt Gingrich's group as well. But as Republicans are quick to point out, if they had the capability of doing this from the top down, they would have done it a long time ago. And so there has to be something organic that they're tending to right now.
Well, Newt Gingrich's group is American Solutions. Dick Armey's group is Freedom Works. And some would say they've also gotten a lot of help from Fox News.
Oh, a huge organizing help from their friends in the press led by Fox News and conservative commentators and bloggers. But then again, though, if the numbers come anywhere close to the expectations, this will be probably the largest conservative-themed series of protests we've ever seen. And in that sense, it's being seen as a test case for the capability of the right to organize in the same way the left has been able to online.
Well, and you write the Republicans aren't sure what to make of this. How so if two leaders, Gingrich and Armey, are behind it?
Well, this doesn't cut cleanly on Democrat-Republican lines. This is a lot more libertarian than anything else. It's anti-government, it's anti-spending, maybe it's anti-Obama, but it's not necessarily pro-Republican. So some Republicans are trying to embrace this, but this could be a force that's anti-incumbent that could affect everyone.
Well, and Sandy asked, you know, who are these people? Are they just the loudest who have always been for a flat tax? And we wonder the same thing, because very few Americans will be paying more taxes under the Obama plan, just the super wealthy. Most people making under $250,000 are actually going to pay less.
That's what the big question is, whether this is the right's answer to MoveOn.org or whether this is essentially the Ron Paul campaign in a bottle today around the country. A lot of folks, including many Republicans, think this is just the noisiest folks who are doing it, but they're going to make some noise today.
Thank you, Rick. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Massachusetts recently passed one of the strictest medical conflict of interest laws in the country. It limits the gifts, meals, and payments that companies can give to doctors and imposes fines for those who don't comply. The American Psychiatric Association also said recently that it will end seminars and meals sponsored by drug companies at its annual meetings. And students at Harvard Medical School are questioning the influence of drug companies on their teachers after the school received a failing grade from the American Medical Student Association for its ability to monitor drug money. 149 Harvard professors have financial ties to the drug company Pfizer. 130 have ties to Merck. Well, pharmaceutical companies have spent billions every year on marketing directly to doctors, and the debate continues about its impact. Today, we'll hear from both sides. A little later, a doctor who says his relationship with drug companies will lead to innovations. But first, Dr. Jerome Kassira, a distinguished professor at Tufts University School of Medicine. He also served as editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine for more than 8 years and is author of On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. So that's where he stands. Dr. Kassira, can you give us an example of ways that you see doctors cross the line with drug companies?
One example is so-called speakers bureaus, where doctors are paid to go out and give lectures for a drug company. Now, those doctors are carefully selected, generally, so that they are ones who like the drug company's drug. But in fact, if they start to talk about the negative aspects of the drug, they're not going to be in the speakers bureau for long. So there's a strong motivation for them to continue to speak on behalf of the company in favor of the drugs.
I actually went with someone who invited me to go to a concert. I said, oh, great. And it turned out it was a concert with a dinner before, the tickets and the meal provided by the drug company representative. Everyone there, and there were about eight couples, was a doctor. And during the dinner, they actually took a few minutes in a kind of winking way to discuss some drug. They went around the table, what do you think of it, what do you think of it? Is it possible that this is an important part of developing drugs, to hear from the doctors what they think about them?
Well, you see, I think it's valuable for doctors to be involved with industry in making drugs because that's good for patient care. But why should doctors be involved with companies to market drugs or their devices? That's not a job for doctors. Doctors should be doing things in the best interests of patients and getting their information from independent sources, not from drug company representatives and not from doctors who are being paid by the drug companies to lecture.
Can you see it endangering health?
I can cite a specific instance. A lot of doctors were promoting the use of Vioxx, and we later learned that there was some danger to the use of Vioxx. And it turned out that when these doctors began to tell their audiences that there was some danger to the use of Vioxx, they were threatened by a Merck vice president.
Well, let's talk about school research. You're with Tufts, and schools claim that they need drug company money to do research that sustains the work of teachers and students. But you say that creates an unspoken quid pro quo.
Increasingly, we're finding out that a lot of the research done by drug companies favors the drugs that the companies are promoting, in part because the drug companies can help design the study in a way to make it come out positive. They can also get rid of a study, not even publish it, if it comes out negative. And it turns out that now a larger fraction of money is spent on drug company research than it is on research at the National Institutes of Health on drugs.
What do you think of the students who are now speaking up, worried that they're about to be influenced. I mean, they just feel this gravitational pull. They see it in their professors, they say, and they're concerned.
Well, I'm delighted to hear what they're doing. In fact, I recommended 5 years ago that students shouldn't be involved with drug company representatives, that doctors should not be taking gifts, that doctors should not be taking meals at all.
Well, we're going to be talking in a second with Dr. Tom Stossel of Harvard Medical School, who's leading or advising a group of students who want to keep the drug company influence. So there's a little debate going back and forth at Harvard. And he writes about a biochemist who in the 70s discovered the first statin, you know, the cholesterol medication. And he says that this was a researcher who was funded by the drug industry. And Stossel says everybody would have jumped on that. Everybody would have said, see, it's industry funded, that's why there's a problem. When in fact, industry funding and persistence and keeping at it with this guy helped produce statins.
I'm not opposed to industry-sponsored research. There are a lot of important drugs that I was able to use during my long career in medicine that would never have surfaced except for the research and industry. I'm not against research by industry at all. But I think it has to be done very carefully, and the investigators need to have control of the data, and they need to be able to publish it. If there's no skids on the investigators by industry, then I'm all in favor.
Have you talked to doctors who have said, I'm impervious, I can do this, I can let Merck or someone else pay for my, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of grad school, I won't be swayed, I won't...
Sure, they tell me that all the time, I don't believe it. There's a good, strong body of evidence that the Association of American Medical Colleges put together just about a year ago showing just the opposite, that people are swayed by money.
Well, finally, what do you think of the new law passed here in Massachusetts?
I think it's good law. It's probably the strongest in the country. It has some features that I'm not crazy about. For example, they still allow doctors to get continuing medical education from drug companies. They still allow doctors to take meals when they're getting that kind of education. But the good is that all of the money that doctors receive from companies now must be disclosed in a public website of the Commonwealth. I think the notion of fining people for violations, I think that's appropriate. It'll catch the attention of people. I know that some people will argue that it will chill research. I don't believe that at all. I don't think it will drive companies out of Massachusetts. There's too much here for them, too many academic institutions, too much talent. They won't leave here.
That's Professor Jerome Casira of Tufts University School of Medicine, also past editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine and author of On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. Well, when we come back, a doctor who's offended by the notion that drug company money affects his decisions. We'll have that. And later, a star is born on the British version of American Idol. Back in 1 minute. Here now. Dr. Tom Stossel, Director of Translational Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, Senior Fellow at the Conservative Manhattan Institute, and someone who served on advisory boards for companies like Merck, Biogen, and Dyax, says there is no reason for concern. And Dr. Stossel, we should also, I'm sure you'd want us to proudly note that you're the brother of John Stossel of ABC News.
That's correct.
That's right. Well, as you know, we just heard from Dr. Jerome Casira. You're well aware of his arguments. He is calling for a firewall between doctors, professors, and drug companies because he says doctors can't help but be compromised when they're seduced by the many gifts and the money that's dangled from drug companies. Your thoughts?
Well, Robin, I'm very puzzled by that. When I get off this call, I'm going to go see patients. And the care that I give those patients compared to when I started out in medicine over 40 years ago isn't even in the same galaxy. And it's because of the amazing tools that I have to work with. And those tools all came from industry, from physicians working with industry. And that interaction needs to be fostered if we're going to continue to have that kind of innovation.
Well, but if the tools also include pens and clipboards and trips to Cancun and, you know, aren't you then a little bit blinded to which medicine you're going to choose?
People who are really in the trenches innovating and seeing patients should be upset. The idea that they're sinking into a sea of corruption and they're too dumb and too gullible to sort out promotional information is really disrespectful.
But, you know, it is filtering down to patients. And as you know, some Harvard students are concerned about that. We spoke to Harvard Medical School student Kristen Ostad. She's part of the group pushing to expose drug company influence at Harvard. And she says it's leading to a mistrust of doctors by patients. Let's listen to Kristen for a second.
A doctor told us a story about how he was visiting his friend's practice and he was writing a prescription with a pen that was on his friend's desk, and the patient asked, "Are you writing me that drug because the name of it's on that pen?"
Dr. Tom Strassel, you say, you know, people would be silly to make that connection between the pen and the prescription, but if they are, aren't you concerned about that?
Well, first of all, let me say, I love the students. You know, the students are idealistic, but they're inexperienced. And I think the answer the physician would give is, no, I'm not writing the prescription because of what's on this pen.
Well, what about Dr. Joseph Biederman? This is the Harvard child psychiatrist who's long advocated an increased use of antipsychotic drugs for kids. As the New York Times reports, he outlined plans to test Johnson & Johnson drugs in presentations to company executives. And one slide in that presentation to executives referred to a proposed trial in preschool kids of risperidone, that's the antipsychotic drug Johnson & Johnson makes, and the slide stated that the trial will support the safety and effectiveness of risperidone in this age group. Now, Dr. Biederman indeed went on to be the lead author of a trial published last year concluding that treatment with risperidone improved symptoms of attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder in bipolar kids. And that's the conclusion he promised before the research, and he's paid for that research. Does that concern you?
Well, every grant that any researcher puts together starts with the assumption that there's a hypothesis that you would like to test, and that if the sponsor is going to buy into it, whether it's the government or whether it's the American Cancer Society or whether it's Johnson & Johnson, they'd like some indication that it might work out in favor of their agenda.
That surprises me. I could see a study proposed. We will find out whether or not risperidone is safe in children. Not our study will support the safety and effectiveness of risperidone.
This is the rhetorical way that it was put. I think that until the study is done, you don't know, and the language in which you propose it is really not relevant.
Well, I guess, you know,
I mean,
I guess
it's this idea that we physicians and researchers are some kind of robotic automatons. I've been in research for 35 years, and they say, you're going to be subtly biased if there's a corporate sponsorship. And my response is, I have never been subtly biased. I have always been totally biased. You have to be biased. You're passionate about your ideas. But when they don't pan out, I admit it. The key thing is, did anybody lie, cheat, or steal? Not what are the motives or the intentions.
What do you think of the new Massachusetts law?
Well, I think that when the self-congratulation is over, we're going to realize that we're just spending a lot of money, and I think it's going to hurt innovation.
Well, let's go back to the Harvard students. You're advising a group of students in favor of drug company ties at the school, but you know on the other side are students like Matt Zerdin. Now, he tells a story about a professor of his who gave an overly positive lecture about cholesterol-lowering drugs, and Matt said he was hostile to questions about side effects. Then he learned later that this professor was a paid consultant for companies that make cholesterol-lowering drugs. Now, since then, Harvard has changed its policy to require professors to disclose these kind of drug company ties. But your thoughts?
I can't imagine why someone would deflect side effect questions, because cholesterol-lowering drugs, even with side effects, are wonderful. I take them. I can have bacon and eggs and not worry about my cholesterol. I'll take a few side effects.
Okay, now you've taken us down a whole other path. You can't be telling us that if somebody with high cholesterol is eating bacon, but I'm going to move on. I'm going to move on, doctor. What do you think, though, about the students' request that they at least have a course, you know, just kind of telling them about what some of the hazards might be? I mean, are you saying that there's not any doctor anywhere that would fall into the pit of seduction and make a wrong decision because of their relationship with the drug company?
Absolutely not. And I'm not saying that industry has always been wonderful. And so I think we need to be vigilant. I think there are many control mechanisms. The attorneys general are out looking around for violations. The industry is heavily regulated. And I think a course is a great idea, but that course should include instruction on how new products come to market and the economics of it, not just about how the whole thing is a morality play. Our students think these great tools we have came from Santa Claus. They didn't. They came from people working in anonymous drudgery, in companies, working with physicians, and has given us great stuff. That is really the bottom line.
That's Dr. Tom Stossel, Director of Translational Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and has served on advisory boards for companies from Merck to Biogen. Dr. Stossel, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll be back after the very latest news here and now. When President Obama meets with Latin American leaders in Trinidad and Tobago later this week, he's expected to face pressure to further normalize U.S. relations with Cuba. He took a few steps in that direction this week, reversing long-standing restrictions on Cuban Americans traveling to Cuba or sending money to their relatives. Michael Voss is the BBC's Cuba correspondent. He's speaking to us from Havana. And Michael, what is meant by lifting restrictions on travel?
Under the Bush administration, Cuban Americans were told they could only come to visit direct relatives on the island once every 3 years, and it had to be either a mother or father or a brother or sister. And there were also very tight restrictions on how much money you could bring and spend and how much you could send home during the year. It was limited to $300 every 3 months. $100 a month was the maximum you could send back to family in Cuba. I mean, for years now, there is a special Terminal 2 at Havana Airport, which is just for charter flights from Miami. Those restrictions are lifted. They can come as often as they want now, and they can also come and visit more than just direct relatives. So, for example, elderly Cubans who've got, you know, whose parents have died and will for the first time in years and years and years be allowed to come to the island to visit family, like nephews and nieces, for example.
Or just touch the ground.
Yes.
Yeah.
The other bit that for Cubans is very important is this question of remittances. You need to remember that in Cuba, the average salary is about $20 a month. And therefore, having access to help, to money being sent home from relatives in the United States, really will be an economic lifeline for tens of thousands of people here.
And how are ordinary Cubans reacting to all of this?
Well, I mean, generally it's been very well received. I think also there is this sense that although it's a small step, we're an awful long way from seeing any end to the decades-old trade embargo, but it is the very first sign that the United States government is taking a policy of engagement. Now people are wondering what comes next. Officially, President Raul Castro has said nothing, but normally he doesn't say very much anyway. He rules very quietly from sort of, you know, corridors of power. It's his elder brother, Fidel Castro, who tends to be the spokesman for this country, and he's been writing regular editorials in the last few days about this. He's called it a small step, and he still wants an end to the embargo, but he's been very careful not to directly criticize President Obama. There's an awful long way to go here, is the official government reaction.
Well, President Obama also lifted restrictions on U.S. telecommunications companies applying for licenses to operate in Cuba. Now, this could potentially open up another flow of information to the island via the Internet. So, you know, the question is the Cuban government going to allow that?
If we're talking about telecommunications companies in terms of mobile phones and roaming, then I'm not sure the Cubans are going to play ball while the trade embargo is underway. Now, when it comes to the Internet, Cubans are forbidden to have Internet at home. You can get access to it at work and in universities and schools and places like that, but you can't have it at home. And the argument has always been that because of the trade embargo, Cuba cannot connect to the big undersea fiber optic cables that run close to the shore that would connect it to the World Wide Web. All Internet in Cuba is by satellite. It's expensive and there's very limited bandwidth. Now, if the Cubans can connect into these fiber optic cables, then it's really going to be a challenge, isn't it, for the authorities here. Will people be allowed to have internet at home? The internet at the moment is slightly censored. If you're trying to log on to anti-Castro websites in Miami from here, they are blocked. But generally, there is free access to the internet here, to pretty much all other sites. I mean, they're very strict about things like pornography. But generally, you can log on to the New York Times or the Washington Post or Time Magazine or the BBC News.com website. So that really could be a big challenge here.
Michael Voss, the BBC's Cuba correspondent in Havana. Michael, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Robin.
Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, first-time short story writer Wells Tower. Have you seen his rave reviews? That's tomorrow. Back in half a minute, Here and Now. Here's how the TV critic in the London Times reviewed a moment in Britain's Got Talent. That's the original British version of American Idol. Contestant Susan Boyle is a spinster who's never been kissed, 47 going on 57 with hair like a crow's nest. The audience guffawed, but then to increasing incredulity and mounting applause, she sang I Dreamed a Dream from Les Miserables and possessed a voice of breathtaking tunefulness and confidence.
When dreams are made and used and wasted, and loss of us is to be made, no sun and sun.
Andrew Billen is the TV critic for the London Times. Andrew, the people in this audience seemed to really be shocked at how much talent this woman had. They had obviously stereotyped her as a loser. It seemed as if the judges and the audience really were shocked by her.
The audience was looking bored, skeptical, cynical, possibly even looking for a complete disaster when this woman came on and said she wanted to be Elaine Page. And within seconds, they were on their feet, cheering, clapping. This was a genuine moment of TV surprise.
Tell us more about why. I mean, you've described her looks. The video is shooting around the world, millions of hits on YouTube to see this. She really seems from another era.
She does, but she's also from Scotland. I think you can live in a little media...
Wait a second. I mean, just for our Scottish listeners, we have to say, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, my auntie died a couple of years ago. She looked a little... I mean, admittedly, she was in her 80s rather than the 40s, but she looked a little bit like Susan Boyle. They're not an awful lot of ordinary-looking people in Britain, you know, and you just don't see them on television very much.
Right, and here she comes with a rather frumpy dress and sings... As you write, breathtaking tunefulness and confidence. Do you think we have already seen the winner?
They're going to have to go some way to beat her. The problem is the image. What do you do with her? You can't really put her in a musical without the most amazing amount of work. And the one thing she can't work on is her age. So she's really reached this height of artistic glory a little bit late in life to be commercial, although she may well have a recording contract in the offing at the end of all this.
Something tells me that we haven't heard the last of Susan Boyle.
She is going to be one of the names of 2009 that we remember the year by. Mark my words.
Andrew Billen, TV critic for the London Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, here we go.
In the small concert hall of Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, flutist Paula Robeson and percussionist Ayano Kataoka rehearse for a birthday tribute for composer Leon Kirchner. The sole audience member at this rehearsal, composer Leon Kirchner.
There's one note that mine that you can't play?
Yeah.
Throw it out.
Okay.
Cancel the concert.
Leon Kirchner is an imposing figure. Like his music, his voice can rise in passionate crescendos. His eyes under bushy brows and a crown of hair are piercing. He wrote this piece, Flutings for Paula, expressly for Paula Robeson in 1973. And it feels as if he is still, at 90, perfecting it.
I'll say in general that you're taking too seriously the fermatas.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Could you make... Daga, a little tiny bit faster. Da-dum, pa-dee. Try that. Da-dum, pa-dee.
Wait.
Wait there. No, hold it. hold it. And then now the next phrase.
Paula Robeson, is that intimidating to have the composer there, or are you so close with him at this point? What is that like?
Well, we're so close. I feel like we're family. But in a sense, Leon is always challenging to play for because he has such a clear vision, and it's so fragile sometimes what he wants, because what is, to me, the most extraordinary about his extraordinary music is the way he reaches for the ineffable, the way he tries to ask us to express the inexpressible.
There's always comparisons to others. How would you describe Leon Kirshner's sound?
When you hear a piece of Kirshner, it can be written by no one else but him.
Tell us why.
The intervals that he uses, the way he uses voice leading. I've often thought about Leon as kind of in a tossing sea. In a boat, when we play a piece, it's as if we're in a some sort of a craft that's on this ocean, and that he's trying to make it to the shore.
In the boat with Kirshner, his early influences, Stravinsky, and most notably his teacher, Arnold Schoenberg, the creator of the 12-tone technique, a system for expressing the atonal, dissonant music of the early 1900s.
Sometimes Schoenberg is writing in the boat with him because he did gain so much from Schoenberg, but Schoenberg comes from the European tradition. Leon is an American, so he has that gutsy, big band kind of tradition that we as Americans have and treasure. And so here we are in the boat. I think some of the Schoenberg disciples made it to the shore. Some of them kind of dried out on the shore. Some of them built gigantic fortresses that nobody could understand. But here Leon kind of stayed at sea. Always reaching. He's always kept his beating heart. As he says of Schoenberg's disciples, so many of them just went with the numbers, the system. They didn't keep the waltz, the heart.
There was Stravinsky, Schoenberg, Bartok, and all the rest. You must never consider them when you talk to people like me. These people were not born on this planet. I am absolutely convinced of that. They were born elsewhere and dropped from a ship onto this earth with parachutes.
Why?
Because they couldn't find any people like that here. These are the great ones. You don't compare them that easily.
Because why? They were hearing something that nobody else could hear before them?
That's right. Nobody else did hear before. That's called genius.
What did it do to you when the world that Stravinsky and Schoenberg presented opened up?
One day, in 1950, I received a phone call, and somebody on the other end had the nerve to say, "This is Igor Stravinsky. I have listened to your quartet. I should like you to come to dinner with your wife." Well, I immediately, being a very clever fellow, said, "I accept. My name is Fyodor Dostoevsky, and I have written some things you might see while you look at the music." And it was actually true.
It was him.
The person said, no, this is Igor Stravinsky. You come on a certain day."
Composer Leon Kirshner, as we listen to a little of the Stravinsky that inspired him as a young man. When we come back, how Leon, in turn, inspired his former student, Yo-Yo Ma, who at first didn't understand when Leon told him to play as if he was careening through the music.
I said, this is what is happening to the harmonies. It's like moving away from the gravity of the sun on a whole new course. And this is what you have to feel. He actually began to careen throughout the world. He would write me a card and say, "I just played with von Karajan last night. I still don't understand what you meant by careening."
Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Thank you. Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. True story. Years ago, I had a next-door neighbor who, for some reason, I thought was a college administrator. But in the summer, his exquisite piano playing would waft through my windows. "Leon," I said to him one day as we walked on the street, "you can really play. You should keep that up." "Really?" he said. Well, he was probably working on pieces like this one, a piano sonata he wrote for Leon Fleischer, because the next day I opened the paper and the headline read, "Leon Kirchner debuts piece with Boston Symphony." When we spoke before Leon Kirchner's tribute concert at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, I reminded him of that story. Kirchner, my former neighbor, is considered one of the greatest living American composers, and recently artists in New York and Boston celebrated his 90th birthday. Here, the Claremont Trio plays Kirchner's Trio No. 2. Leon Kirchner says composers are a little bit lucky, like atoms in a particle accelerator.
It's just like a boxing match. Boom! Particles. And that's what happens also when you meet a great idea, particles, and then you breathe easily and you just begin to do the thing that comes most natural to you. That's about it.
But you don't reject the past to do that.
Oh no, that was what was wrong in 1950-60.
This is Arnold Schoenberg's Verflirtenacht. Kirchner studied with Schoenberg and says modern composers misunderstood him, thinking his dissonant 12-tone technique meant a rejection of the romantic harmonies that came before. Kirchner happened to reread Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus. Remember, the devil asked the protagonist, a composer, to cut off his ties to music's melodic past. Kirchner refused to make that Faustian bargain, and he says his teacher Schoenberg refused as well.
Although he was the 12-tone master, he said, turn to the passage, you know, you can still write a work in C major. He never divorced himself from the past.
Can I ask you to speak about Yo-Yo Ma? I was interested to read that when you taught him, you've been called his greatest mentor at Harvard, that you were very critical of him.
I'm always critical of everyone whom I respect. I did tell Yo-Yo one day, I said, you know, Yo-Yo, he has the quality of genius. He's probably one of the greatest cellists alive. But I told him, you know, you don't have any center to your tone. There's no center to your tone. He was shocked that I said, I don't mean just the tone of your cello. I mean the tone of your soul. And sometime later, a cellist named Rostropovich came and asked for five people. He wanted to give a master class, and I selected the best of them. Rostropovich came out, first child played, "Ah, it's beautiful, beautiful." The second one came in, he said, "Ah, like Christmas cake." And then the third one came, fourth one came, and he said something else, all of the same order. And when the fifth one came,
Yo-Yo Ma.
Yo-Yo Ma, he said, "You know, you have no center to your tone."
Do you remember the moment when he did find it? Because obviously he did.
Yes, he found it the next day, actually.
And what is it? What did he get?
He got hold of life.
Yo-Yo Ma was in the audience at the Gardner Museum to see his former teacher feted, and afterward it was obvious that the classroom teachings stayed with him.
Where's your core? Where is your core?
Just how tough, Yo-Yo Ma, was Leon Kirchner on you?
He was my boulder in the road, as he calls himself. He was so loving, but he really liked to create challenges. And I think, in hindsight, rightfully so, because he had an unbelievable vaulting imagination. And he challenged everybody to try and rise to that level of thinking and of feeling and of making sure that the sounds that we make are powered by ideas as well as feelings.
What do you feel when you play Kirchner music?
Well, clusters, gestures, shapes, and movement, and all kind of jostling together, you know, bursting sparks, and I mean, just amazing colors. They're just kind of exploding, but also full of heart. You know, we were joking earlier about the rapapapapim, you know, it's these wave-like motions that can come out of his brain and in his writing and his singing and his personality.
This is a piece that Leon Kirchner wrote for Yo-Yo Ma. It's called Music for Cello and Orchestra. I asked Leon Kirchner, given the mutual affection between the two, what kind of a piece did he want to write?
Well, I wrote the most beautiful piece because that's what my wife said. I said, what should I do next? Write something that has beauty in it. And so I put my whole heart and soul into that work, and he gave it one of the most wonderful performances.
You mentioned your late wife, Gertrude.
Yes.
I heard a story about how Yo-Yo came and played for her when she was dying.
Yeah. Well, Gertrude was very ill, and she was sort of sleeping, and Yo-Yo just had this wonderful habit of coming and playing a Bach Sarabande, or actually a whole suite. I said, Gert, Yo-Yo, she adored Yo-Yo. Somebody was talking about pickles and music. I don't know how that came up. And so I said, well, Gert, what do you want? Do you want pickles or Yo-Yo? She said, pickles. So I said, that's terrible. I didn't say that to her. But Yo-Yo closed his cello, banged it, went out. And that was the end of him, it seemed, until he came back about an hour later with six different pickle bottles and presented them to her. And then he played one of the great suites, Bach. And that was a great, grand, grand affair. Wonderful, wonderful human being.
It was so fantastic. Oh, this is... We're going to careen away.
One last kiss from Yo-Yo Ma to his former teacher, composer Leon Kirchner, who turned 90 this year. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.